Hi, I'm Melissa Rosenberg. I'm a senior editor at Washingtonian and a correspondent for TheAtlantic.com.
And I'm Seth Coulter-Walls. I'm a writer in the critics section at Newsweek magazine and on the website, and I blog at The All.
Awesome. Well, I have been a huge fan of yours for a long time, so I'm glad that you and I can finally sit down and talk.
The reverse is true as well. I need to get that in there before we start.
Well, I have this sort of running idea that you're much more sophisticated than I am. I sort of blog about the meaning of pop culture, and I feel like you actually know much more about the mechanics of cultural production than I do. And this feeling of sort of admiring insecurity is kind of the piece that epitomizes that for me. Is this great piece you did for Newsweek recently about how PBS hasn't done everything it could do to broadcast opera. And I thought that was interesting because I have this idea of opera as something that is very sophisticated and emotive and moving, and yet I have no idea how to get into it. I go to the movies and they have these trailers for Met operas that are showing on the big screen,
right,
but I don't know which ones I would like. And I was wondering, how do you get into opera in the first place? How do you learn how to appreciate it? So when it's on PBS or, showing in a big screen movie theater and it's one of those big Fathom events, you know what to go to.
Well, I mean, I think, first off, the problem is one that I think is pretty common, actually. I mean, you're an incredibly smart person and your writing's really great. There's absolutely no reason that you should be specifically so intimidated about, how to find an entry point into a genre like opera. But this is something that I think is sort of strangely, uniquely American in the sense that because a lot of our cultural institutions aren't publicly funded the way they would be, say, in Europe, for a long time, the sort of economic reality of producing this stuff in America is that they have to go to really rich people and say, hey, give me $30 million, this year so that I can lose a bunch of money putting on a really expensive type of theater that has no type of economic scalability over time. It takes precisely the same number of musicians, to play Don Giovanni today as it did in Mozart's time. There's no way to have a cost savings over time. So, the consequence of that, is that we have this, in movies and in, going back to the Marx Brothers, Night at the Opera, right? Like the sense that opera's for the rich people because they're the ones who, put on their jewelry and fund it and go to it. So that's, I think, sort of uniquely American, and, I chafe against that. I don't like that, and think that, public television in particular has a role to play in, as it does in many other realms, making things accessible to the public.
I think it's interesting that you bring up A Night at the Opera, because I think most of the time that we see opera in contemporary pop culture, it's some sort of signifier of sophistication. The scene in Pretty Woman where Richard Gere, gets Julia Roberts the great necklace for the evening and puts her on the plane, and, the whole point is that she can't really understand what's going on. It's kind of a condescending scene, right?
Right.
But she's moved by it, and that's how we know that, she has a finer sensibility and she should be something other than a hooker because, she gets it. She's
the reason to not be a hooker is
moved.
that you would know about opera. That would be the upshot.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but it's like this in the Winona Ryder adaptation of Little Women, the way we know that Gabriel Byrne's professor is like kind of a cool, sensual dude who might actually be better for Joe than, her boyhood friend Laurie Christian Bale. Mm-hmm. Because he's Laurie in Little Women, I can never watch American Psycho because I can't reckon with the idea that my sort of girlhood idol would cut up all those ladies. But
right.
That's a diversion. But the professor takes Joe to the opera and they sit backstage and he translates for her and then they kiss and it's, but again, she doesn't know what's going on. And I think opera sort of set up to be really intimidating, not just because it's, it's a rich people thing, but because it's a sophistication thing.
You know, that's true on the one hand. I guess it's just, in Europe, I think, before the advent of the movies, it was much more just like going to the movies, the classical, sort of Viennese music tradition, the Germanic kind of domination of classical music for, centuries or whatever. I think it was just sort of more commonplace and people would go to it just to go to it the way they would, go to a movie today. But to answer your question, I mean, I think especially in American culture, those movies that you cite, it's not even confined to strictly class, even within a class, like in Hannah and her sisters, I don't know if you recall the scene, you know, where the two women who are running the catering business both want the one guy, and he takes them to the opera, and it's like, you know, kind of sensitive, and they understand that he's really, you know, he's classy because he's doing that, and it causes some level of tension for the less secure of the two women. And, you know, it's, you know, we're talking about Manhattanites in a Woody Allen film here, so it's really pretty pervasive.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's too bad, because there's, as with anything that has a degree of sophistication to it, the correct answer, the question that you originally posed, you know, where do I start or what's the entry point, is just to start somewhere, right? Like, it's not like when you start to read, you don't read the most important book ever first or really sweat it or not read a book until you can sort of figure out what that book might be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as much as I get to write, you know, about opera for Newsweek, which is not terribly frequently, and, you know, I also write about it for The All, you know, I try to sort of demystify it a little bit and you know, say that even if you are not going to get this or that aspect of it, there's an incredible amount for any smart person with a native intelligence about culture to scoop up on a first pass.
Well, and even that, I mean, I guess I sometimes wonder if maybe the way to encourage people to get into opera is actually to kind of roll with the pop culture of depiction and say, you don't have to get every single word, you don't have to understand everything,
right.
But the emotion is so huge, the voices are so huge. You know, this is a chance to go to a cultural event and feel something bigger than you normally do, and to sort of appeal to people's emotions and mm-hmm. their confidence and their ability to feel rather than necessarily their ability to understand and their intellect.
I think that's a good, like, I think, you know, probably what would be like most ideal would be a multi sort of tong approach. And that would be like a strong, one of a tine on a fork or a tong that you would employ. I think another one, and this specifically has to do with people who are younger, because like with lots of performing arts, there's sort of a age demographic crisis at work in opera, mm-hmm. much the same as there is with jazz or, you know, live theater even, where the audience is aging really rapidly, is to emphasize, and this is sort of what I wrote a little bit about in that Newsweek piece that kicked this off, is to emphasize the contemporary relevance of the form in the sense of, like, you know, if you go to, you know, the Whitney Museum or something, or if you go to MoMA, or if you're going to Mass MoCA, or if, you know, you're interested in what's happening at SF MoMA, or if you're just interested in modern art, full stop, you know, there are composers that have been working, that are working now, and that have been working over the last 100 years, apace with modernism, who have things to show you. And
so it's not just dead Italians.
Exactly, right. And I happen to really, really like the 20th century stuff and some of the contemporary mm-hmm. stuff. And I feel like, you know, I've taken several friends to their first opera, including this writer, Mary H.K. Choi, who also writes for The All. And, you know, when she asked me what opera should I go to first, I said, you know, I said something that was sort of, you know, counterintuitive in the sense that let's go see like a 4-hour modernist atonal opera that's really crazy and has lots of, you know, kind of jagged edges that opera programmers would normally say that's actually not, you know, the way that you should start opera. Here's a nice, you know, comfortable Mozart or mm-hmm. something, and you do this, and she loved it. And I think that's, you know, for a certain set of, you know, urbanite or, you know, broadly sophisticated, anybody who is online all day chewing up stuff about culture and thinking about it is perfectly ready to take that on. And I think just sort of clearing away some of the misconceptions about that at a administrative level in opera companies is important. And then also just making that sort of the public, the public facing like attitude about it. Like, it's not that hard, you know,
well,
come in, try it.
It sounds like one of the things that you're saying is that people in opera companies need to think about multiple entry points,
right?
Because what you're describing is sort of like, you know, I have some friends who are new music composers and big indie rock nerds,
right.
And, you know, you make a different pitch to them than someone who, say, really liked, you know, one of the more challenging musicals that's on Broadway now. Like, you know, and I can see it being an easier sell to go to someone who loved Passing Strange, which is this,
right.
I thought, just fantastic, you know, basically indie rock musical put together by a guy named Stu about, you know, sort of black identity and music in Los Angeles,
right.
Amsterdam,
and
Germany.
Directed film version of it that people can
right. And so there's a
check out if they
there's
can
a different. It. I think there's a different pitch for people who like musicals but like the sort of unusual musicals as opposed to not that there's anything wrong with liking Wicked or you know.
Right.
Being a huge Rent fangirl.
In fact,
the
guy who composed Wicked has an opera, Cume Opera, actually premiering at New York City Opera in the fall.
I think it's, you know, the sort of, the interstitial stuff, the works that are kind of between forms,
mm-hmm.
whether it's, you know, something kind of atonal for, you know, people who are real smart about sort of the technicalities of music, or something that can sort of appeal to the emotions of people who like musicals, you know, for the sort of the swell of feeling and the sort of dramatization
right.
of emotion.
And, you know, I mean, and something else that I think is not well understood is that it's actually, it can be very, like, you know, comparatively, I mean, people think it's much more expensive to go to the opera than it actually is a lot of times. I mean, you can go to almost any house in the country unless it's a very small one and therefore they're having to sort of maximize every seat. But at any, like, large-scale nationally sort of important house, you know, you can sit in the back or in one of the balcony zones for not much more than the cost of, you know, a movie ticket in Manhattan or even just rock or hip-hop shows. And, you know, some people might think, oh, there's a stigma about that, like, because you're far away. I mean, actually, sometimes aficionados actually like those seats because that's where you get the richest sound from the orchestra. So it's actually, the rap is, you know, untrue in that regard.
Well, and it seems, it actually seems to me like now might be a really good moment to try and convince sort of sophisticated pop fans to cross over to opera. You know, I know one of the artists both you and I love, this woman Janelle Monáe,
right.
Sort of Atlanta by way of Kansas and New York, and her debut album came out earlier this year, is to me feels very operatic. It's this sort of big, complicated, mythical narrative, lots of science fiction overlay.
Right.
Really sort of rich emotion and complicated sound, and I can see that album, The Arch Android, transferring to the stage incredibly easily.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of strange, you know, operatic, we have like an idea of what it means, but it could actually mean like any number of things because just to like button up the opera thing and move on to Janelle, like I think that, you know, nobody would say, like, people have a very fixed idea of what opera is, like, to say operatic is, like, to mean a certain thing, but nobody would say, like, oh, you know, take the most popular type of, you know, novel or something, like Dan Brown or Da Vinci Code. If you said that you were interested in novels, people wouldn't necessarily automatically say, oh, you know, you must be a huge fan of Dan Brown, you know, you like novels. And that's the kind of the way that it works with opera, because, and I think in this country, particularly because we've sort of privatized the understanding of it, and
mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think PBS should be showing more stuff, the greater diversity in terms of aesthetic, to sort of just let people know that there's an entry point for them if they're a Janelle Monáe fan, there's an entry point for them if they're a fan of Wicked, and that's going on in communities all over the country, not just New York, by the way. I mean, you know, New York is only getting John Adams's landmark 87 opera, Nixon in China, for the first time next year, and it's been in Cincinnati, it's been in Denver, it's been all over the country, so I mean, it premiered in Houston, so this is like, this is not some sort of even egghead, you know, Beltway, deep New York corridor, like, exclusive thing. But anyway.
Or rich people, Upper West Side, diamonds,
right.
dresses.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But Janelle Monáe actually is, I mean, I think that's right. And your, I think, you know, your hypothesis that this is a good moment to get people excited about transitioning a little bit or thinking in a little bit of a broader way about what they might actually be able to enjoy is, I think, spot on with regard to her. There's actually even a really great interpolation of Debussy's Clair de Lune in the next to the last song on the Arc Android, which is just moved half a step down from the original key. And, you know, I think that stuff like that, and even the way that in the liner notes to the Arc Android, Monáe and her collaborators, you know, just reference a lot of other art. They say, you know, this song is dedicated to, you know, Salvador Dali, this you know, song is dedicated to this or that, like, R&B great.
I kind of feel like she is, to me, Monáe is kind of the epitome of something that's happening musically, especially among women right now. You know, because I think, you know, her album is sort of a great example of just very rich, complicated sound. But if you look at the way that Lady Gaga has been staging her tour, for example, it's this, you know, big, emotive focus on spectacle.
I'm going to, like, I want you to finish, but I'm going to actually have to, like, just distinguish something between Gaga and Monet sure. a second, but go ahead and finish.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that there is... You forwarded me this article from the New York Times on sort of... that hypothesized that there's this sort of anti-sincerity moment among women in pop right now.
Right.
That actually kind of drove
me crazy. And particularly girl pop, right? I mean, it's sort of like...
Yes.
That, right? Because Lilith Fair, the sort of archetypal... campfire sort of singer-songwriter tenderness, like Festival of 10 years ago, tried to relaunch this year and kind of fizzled and had to cancel a lot of dates. Meantime,
yeah,
sort of,
and Monet was actually on part of the tour, but that's sort of a divergent.
Right,
but,
and, as well as Erykah Badu, so it wasn't like exactly as clean as a vision as it used to be. But
yeah, but I think, I mean, to me, the sort of, the very interesting thing about women in pop is not this sort of anti-sincerity movement, which I think is a misreading mm-hmm. of a lot of the artists involved. But I actually think there's this very sort of exciting, emotive vision among a lot of female artists that's about sort of creating big myths, that just because they're myths doesn't make them any less true
right.
to women's experience. One of the things that drove me crazy about that article was the idea that...
The John Caramanico Times piece?
Not so much, but just that just because you're sort of creating a personality,
yeah.
Just because you're sort of putting on an identity, which I think a lot of these women artists do, means that you're not sort of speaking honestly, or that the art that you produce or the identity that you produce
right.
isn't sincere or coming from a genuine place.
Right.
I mean,
no, I agree that it's not a one-to-one thing like that, but I actually have trouble hearing... the sincerity and, or, you know, the Gaga stuff actually doesn't really resonate for me at that deeper level. I mean, the melodies are infectious and great, but I actually feel like she's very purposefully avoiding that type of constructive meaning. I think she's sort of in the realm of the signified, kind of an anarchist, you know, which is fine, but I just don't think, I mean, I think for me as a listener, it doesn't actually kind of add up emotionally the same way that the work of Janelle Monáe does, or maybe, or even Robin.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think of Lady Gaga and Robin, who I just adore,
right.
you know, Swedish singer-songwriter, huge sort of teeny bop star for a minute in the 90s, and who totally reinvented herself.
Absolutely, yeah.
As an indie heroine.
Yeah, and she's, I mean, already going to have, like, two of the best singles of the year, at least, it seems like, between Dancing on My Own and Hang With Me.
Yeah, and you have to factor Cry When You Get Older in there, too, which is,
yes,
I think,
no,
sort
that's
of a
true.
Classic.
That's your G-Chat status now, actually, is the line from that song. And I was looking at that this morning, and what is it? It's I Lost My Faith in Science, So I Put My Faith in Me.
Yeah, you've revealed me as sort of terribly corny for the world to know.
Sorry, I shouldn't have outed your G-Chat status.
it's okay, I imagine I'll live. But
right, but I think that's, there's a difference between that lyric and, like, or even the lyric of Hang With Me and Bad Romance, which I think is pretty telling, which is that... go ahead.
I mean, I don't want to argue with you here, but I actually have come to hear Lady Gaga and Robin's lyrics in very similar ways. And I realize...
So crazy to me.
And I realize this is a little bit down in the weeds, but I think we're in this moment where among the things that women are being really sincere about mm-hmm. in pop music is a desire to be alone, or sort of an embrace of being on your own.
Right.
You mentioned, you know, sort of Bad Romance earlier. This huge spectacle video. It's got sort of nonsense chanting. It's, you know, some of the lyrics are ridiculous.
Right.
And then towards the end, you have this great sort of wailed line in the chorus. And Gaga says, you know, I want your love and I want your revenge. I want your love. I don't want to be friends.
Right.
And the inflection totally changes in that verse. I mean, she's sung this before in the song, and it's this rare, really sort of naked moment. And
I guess I have trouble hearing it as naked. I think this is in part due to, you know, her incredible level of craft with regard to her image, but I very rarely feel like she's naked at all in that way. Like, I feel like it's very studied and purposeful, but not necessarily true in a way. And I think that, you know, I think that you're right that there is this, like, ability to be, like, to declare wanting to be alone or whatnot happening with women in pop right now. But I think the critical, the thing that makes me just have such a greater degree of, you know, like, I mean, I feel like some of those Robin songs on Body Talk Part One that came out earlier this year, and it's going to be followed up by two sort of short album, long EP length volumes later this year, is that those songs, even when she's saying that she wants to be alone or that, she, you know, they kind of reach down my throat and just, like, pull the pathos out in a way that Gaga never does, even if I can sort of, like, respect the, like, grandiose nature of the artifice of it all. But, like, in the song Hang With Me, if we're talking about Bad Romance, you know, that also is, she, Robin has a line in that song where she says, you know, so you want to be friends, you know, like, if you're really going to do right by me, then you can hang with me. But
yeah,
I feel like there's like a sensual tension in that song, which is that she's telling this guy, you know, okay, we don't have to be together. I can be alone and you can even be my friend. But if you're going to be my friend, you have to be very careful about falling breathlessly, heedlessly in love with me.
Yeah.
And the synth line in the electronic version of the song that's going to be on Body Talk Part 2, it's this arpeggio that, like, just goes up and up this scale and back down. It's just, it's like, it's this incredible tension with the lyric, which is telling you don't fall in love with me, and this music is telling you fall in love with me. Whereas with Bad Romance, I feel like Gaga's saying, like, you know, what you're saying, like, I'm, you know, this kind of vehement thing and defiant kind of willingness to be alone. But, you know, the song is just hitting the same note that the lyric is. It's like it's A minor, and it's just kind of like pounding the same thing. It's not as, I just don't think it's as, like, deep, you know, an emotional experience that way. And I feel like that's much more like what I tend to get from Gaga and what I really prize about what I get from Robin. So
I guess I look at them as sort of complementary. And I sent you this sort of hilarious David Brooks column from 2007, which I think is one of the funniest pieces of misguided mass cultural criticism to just come out in a long time. And it's, I mean, it's hilarious, right? He takes these, a couple of songs from, like, Pink and Avril Lavigne,
right,
and expresses some sort of shock and dismay that, like, girls don't want to get felt up in the club, or that, you know.
I'm not sure that's exactly what he was going for, but that is a funny reading, yeah. David Brooks, why won't the girls want to get felt up in a club, please? It used to be when we were all, you know, bobos that we loved getting felt up in the club, and now, after, you know, September 11th, we don't like getting felt up in the club. Anyway, sorry, that was a bit of...
No worries, you're gonna, I feel like ending up in a sort of giggling jag is kind of the best way to go here. But he was just very sort of perplexed by the idea that, you know, women would have this kind of sincere music that was about sort of independence, and I think that the songs that he mentioned in that column and a lot of Lady Gaga's work and a lot of Robin's work function for me as a kind of continuity.
Okay.
Because, you know, Pink's last album was sort of about her divorce. She's reconciled with her husband now. But a lot of it is about being independent, whether it's financially independent, whether it's the right to see a guy but send him home after a couple of nights when she really just needs the house to herself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Lady Gaga, I think, has this aesthetic of almost sort of repulsion towards sex. One of the things that I thought was so interesting about her video for Alejandro, and the song is literally about not wanting to be touched at all, is, you know, there's all of this writhing around on beds and pseudo-S&M stuff,
right,
but it's all very, it's very intentionally unsexy. And then Robin exists at this other continuum where, you know, she would really love to be loved. And
I like that much more. I mean, can I say that I like that willingness to sort of be subject to the mammalian, like, laws of desire and like, sexuality? I feel like there's something just, like, a little bit, I mean, it's definitely...
Yeah, I feel like being subject to mammalian laws of desire isn't that romantic, but...
Well, not, I mean, you know...
If that's how you roll.
Right.
I'm teasing.
Well, it is cruel, but, I mean, that's, like... You know, I think one of the things that really endeared me to Robin on the first Body Talk record, you know, on that song, what is it? You can cry later. What's the full name of it?
Cry when you get older.
Right. You know, like the first things that she says is she says she's got something on her dirty mind. You know, which is a throwback to Prince when he actually had a soul in that sense. You know, where Prince can't be heard anymore. You know, like all of his songs are sort of these boasts about how nobody can make as much money distributing their CDs in British tabloids as he can, you know? But, like,
yeah.
But, you know, back And when you were mine, you know, and on Dirty Mind, he was capable of being hurt. And I think that's what made all that music really sexy and great. And, you know, I think that's what Robin's doing really well right now. And I don't, and so to that extent, that's what I just sort of find wanting in the Gaga thing, even as I can recognize that that's probably intentional.
I mean, I guess I just think that, you know, a bunch of the music that's come out by women right now, you know, some days when you're single, you feel really defiant about it, and you want everyone to stay far away, and some days you're, you know, you're out dancing, and you really wish someone would turn around and look at you, but, I mean, I don't think, you know, I think one of the reasons I find this sort of emotional spectrum appealing is because it's not coherent. It can be kind of a mess. It can be, you know, don't fall in love with me, but really I wish you would.
Right.
It can be, you know, I kind of don't want you to touch me, but maybe you can take me home anyway. It's, you know, and I think that kind of ambiguity is honest to what people feel. I mean, I think, especially when it comes to women and sex a lot, there's this insistence that women be sure of what they feel 100% of the time, and that's a ludicrous expectation. And I feel like we finally have a pop music that reflects that. It's not, you know, this isn't sentimental. It's
right.
not all about,
or always having
you know,
to be ready or something, or like, you know, like on point.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, I mean, I don't know if you've heard Lady Gaga's song Monster, which I think is one of her most, it's one of her least concealed songs. And it's interesting to me that it hasn't been a single, but I think there's a pretty clear reason why. It's about getting date raped. And the song has this incredible chorus, or sorry, a verse later in the song where she says, you know, I want to just dance, but he took me home instead. Oh, there was a monster in my bed. And it's this great description of, like, wanting to go up to a certain point and not being allowed to stop. I mean, I think, you know, when people, when there are discussions about, you know, date rape and, you know, when, where consent ends and where consent begins, the idea that there is, that there's a pop song out there that just articulates that so cleanly, it's kind of astonishing to me. I, you know, I feel sort of lucky to live in a moment when we've got that, and when the person who writes that song can also do sort of ridiculous spectacle. Does that make any sense?
I mean, absolutely. Like no, actually, focusing. No, you've sold me, I mean, you've sold me on the complementary aspect of these multiple artists and the sort of like broader complexity that they represent in Toto. And I'll go back and take your reading of Monster and listen to that song more closely. And I think that's smart. But just from a dumb male user experience, there's like not as much for me to connect to there maybe. But or maybe I'm just dim about it. But everybody has their blind spots. But I also think
what's interesting about an artist like Lady Gaga is, you know, to a certain extent, she's not for heterosexual dudes, and I'm not sure she really cares, you know?
Right, and, like, that's, and of course that's fine. Right.
But she's also the biggest...
Check, right, yes.
Well, and yeah, hey, we get the biggest pop star in the world for once, you know?
No, fair,
you guys,
fair enough.
Madonna was, you know, engineered for you guys, but we get this one. Maybe the third time around we can get somebody who's built for both.
Maybe it's just needs to bend the collective unconscious in its direction in a less heteronormative way, then maybe that's fine too.
Yeah.
Of course that would be fine. But that actually is an interesting little, there's like a little tendril of that that like snakes back to opera as well, because I mean that is something that it can, in contemporary male culture, is like very dominated by gay men in terms of like opera aficionado-dom. Like, one of the things, you know, I haven't been writing about culture in public for that long, it's just a couple of years actually, but one of the things that was really a treat for me was when sort of the OG old school opera blogger, La Cieca, who runs the site parterre.com, asked me to do a post about an upcoming, something that was happening at the New York Philharmonic this season. And, you know, it's like the world's queer opera zine is sort of like the tagline on the site. And
love it.
And it's in, you know, the character of La Cieca, the doyen of the site, you know, is this you know, man who's in drag in different iterations whenever you, like, refresh the page, you know? I mean, it's very, and, you know, that was a thrill for me because I thought, okay, you know, this, I mean, it's such smart commentary on that side all the time. But it is very much the province, you know, and thought to be sort of, you know, exclusively so. I think lots of men think it's sort of, you know, well, that's gay to go to the opera. And So I don't know. I think, you know, smashing those boundaries in pop as well as in opera would be probably to the overall benefit.
You can be the feminist Hulk of opera.
Feminist
Hulk.
Right.
God. Not to be a Twitter nerd.
Yes,
but,
let me get off this and get on Twitter. And I'm going to own that meme. I'm going to own it.
Well, I'm glad I can, you know, give you a project. I wanted
see,
to go back
see,
to Robin.
You're not that unsophisticated after all.
I wanted to go back to Robin for a second, because I think she gets at something that both of us are very interested in. And it's this idea of sort of artistic reputation, because it's kind of unthinkable that someone like Britney Spears, you know, she may have shaved her head, but she came back with extensions making a pure pop album.
Right.
Whereas someone like Robin, you know, was pop and sort of minorly pop. You know, Show Me Love is the only song from her early Over that anyone really remembers. Mm-hmm. And she just went away, and maybe this is, you know, one of the benefits of living in a cold European country is you can disappear for a while, come back to the American market, mm-hmm. and, you know, just forge a new reputation for yourself.
It was also a long time, too. I mean, it was like 10 years. I mean, there was like a stopgap album somewhere in there, but and she had label problems, but yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I just think that the question of sort of who controls an artist's reputation and sort of how reputation gets made is very, I think, sort of random to me. And you had this piece about this novelist who has essentially been forgotten and his books are being sold off at the Strand and nobody cares, even though they would help people understand his literature and understand his books. And I thought that was just fascinating because, you know, in the piece you talk about how fans of his work have sort of gone out, bought some of the stuff up, but even, you know, there's not enough clout there to make sure that they get into a library or...
Right. So we write our little articles and send them into the void. David Markson is, you know, I think consistently sort of thought of as one of the most underrated American novelists by a certain sort of literary set for, like, you know, going back a couple decades to...
And I'll admit, I'd never heard of
him
until
and
I read
it. It's crazy, right? And I had heard of him, but I'd actually, and you know, sort of shamefully had not read him in depth mm-hmm. until he died. And I thought, you know, this is, I'm going to get after this. And I read, you know, several of his books in the space of a week and kind of went back and reread. I mean, some of his books are, his later books are really very elusive in style. I mean, elusive in that they are built up from culled aphorisms and literary anecdotes from the lives of great artists. And
is this just your way of proving that you're cooler than all those people who went out and read Infinite Jest after David Foster Wallace died? You picked someone more obscure.
No. I mean, I also did that too. I mean, I wrote about that the other year. You know, I mean, I read Wallace before. I mean, I definitely took part in that Infinite Summer that happened. I guess it was it summer 2009? It must have been. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he died in late 2008. Mm-hmm. I'm very subject to death trends. I'm not ashamed to admit it. This is sort of, not to like keep going back to the opera thing, but we do have this sort of mania about, mm-hmm. Am I informed enough or what am I missing? You know, like I, how could I ever start listening to opera? Like, I'm, you know, where would I start? Right. And death often gives us like a very good punctuation mark in life to say, okay, now it's time to take stock of this person or this thing in the arts. And so I think some people are sometimes, like you said, like, am I trying to prove that I'm cooler than the people who did that? Like, you know, no, I think that we should really as much as possible strip away a lot of the like stylish judgment about timing, you know, when it comes to absorbing art. Like, oh, like you're just doing it now because people are like talking about it. Like, that's fine. Like, please go ahead.
On the other hand, when someone dies, it sort of gives you cover, right? If, you know, if you've never read Infinite Jest, which I have to admit I never have, but all of a sudden 20,000 other people are, and, you know, there's a blog about it, and it's a project, it becomes a lot easier to sort of slip in and have the fact that you didn't know something or you didn't read something.
But why does it have to be that you... Why do you have to slink? Why is your, you know, why is the verb that you employ suggest, like, slinking in the dead of night, you know? I mean, it's not even, like, there's no need to sort of be secretive about it, like... You know, or to sort of say that you're, you know, trying to whitewash something that you were ignorant of previously. I mean, I think, you know, that whole mode of thinking gets at something which I think is pretty American, which is this sort of the collision of, you know, a populist, you know, Jeffersonian, like, you know, proudly not formally educated notion mixed with, you know, a lot of status and class anxiety that we have and the desire for upward social mobility and holding those two things in mind at the same time, I think, often winds up making Americans, and I'm not excluding myself from this, it's just I've lived abroad and worked abroad, and I don't see it quite the same in Europe or even, like, in Lebanon, but, like, there's this sort of shame and constant, like, sort of self-inventory about what do I know and when did I know it and how open can I be about my blind spots with people. You know, I think that's, there's something kind of American about it.
And I think our day-to-day cultural conversations might actually be a lot healthier if we could just say, I haven't read this, but I'm curious.
Right.
Or,
absolutely.
You know, I read this and I hated it. You know, one thing I'm always sort of ashamed to admit is I feel this sort of lingering sense of guilt because I hated White Noise. I hated it. I thought it was awful.
You know who else did? David Markson. That was what we discovered. That was what we discovered when his copy of White Noise was sold at the Strand to, I think, a college student who bought it just as though, and this is how the whole thing kicked off, this notion that after Markson died in June, all of the annotated books from his personal library just got fed into the... And now some information is coming out suggesting that that's the way that he properly wanted it, like, because he sort of was scattering his ashes in a way, but I think that's the kind of...
I like that.
I think that's kind
of
the wish
the
that
idea.
You ignore, a la, like, Kafka's, like, let's burn all my manuscripts, you know, I think that...
I don't know.
I think we should, I mean, like, collect his work, but that's what happened, is that a kid was reading White Noise, was reading all this stuff in the margins, like, oh, bullshit, and this is, you know, oh, God, you know, like, and saying that it's Markson, you know, who is a committed, you know, experimental novelist, was saying, you know, this is crap. And this guy, we don't know if it was a man or a woman, wrote this professor and said, you know, I bought this book. It's got all this crazy marginalia. And I looked in the front. I saw the name David Markson. I had to look it up. Apparently he's a novelist, you know. And then this teacher ends up talking to a guy at the London Review of Books who goes and buys, you know, several kind of amazing sounding books. And he writes a blog post about it. And then I literally run from my desk in the West Village to go run over to the Strand to start poking through for a couple of hours, and I find, you know, Markson's Don Quixote and, like, you know, some other, and some Sartre, in which Markson's yelling at Sartre, you know, that he's an idiot at one point. Anyway, but yeah, so you hate White Noise, and so did David Markson, so there's, you know, there's validation.
Yeah, I was trying to be sort of authentic and, you know, confess something, and now I find out it puts me in company with a cool experimental novelist. I guess I can't escape being hip if I try.
Right, no, you're so cool, Alyssa. You don't even need to work at it.
But I love, and I know, I love the idea of sort of a literary scattering of ashes. I know it's terrible for scholarship, but I think that's a really sort of beautiful idea. One of the books I own that I love the most is a collection of Alexandre Dumas short stories that I found at the Harvard bookstore in Cambridge. And when I bought it, I knew it was an old edition, and I looked it up, and it turned out it was part of a collection that a small press in Boston had done, and they're hand-numbered. And so I've been trying to track down the other volumes in my set ever since. And I think the sort of crazed book collector in me thinks that there's something kind of charming about a world where you can continue to find things like that.
Yeah.
And not everything is cataloged and sort of systematic.
No, I think that's fair. I mean, I think in the case of Markson, what's kind of particularly tragic is that, you know, not all of the books from his collection need to be in an archive. You know, I mean, some of them are just interesting and great collector's items that totally should be the kinds of things that fans should, you know, have a kind of particular literary lust to acquire, you know.
Yeah.
But there is some stuff, especially because, you know, he was such a, you know, sampler of other writers in his own prose, for lack of a better word, better word that can occur to me at the moment. He, you know, it's interesting to see what he was reading on all of the subjects that were sort of his great fascinations, and then to see what was withheld from his own texts, to sort of get a sense, like, the same way that you would with deleted scenes on a bonus DVD for a movie that you really love. It's kind of, you know, it'd be great for the stuff that does give you a glimpse into that to be cataloged, which is what's actually happening on Facebook right now in a sort of virtual way. You know, I uploaded a scan to this, like, Facebook group that was dedicated to people who buy his books and want to tell everybody what's in them. And, you know, people have been uploading scans of sort of the most relevant pages of his marginalia, and that's, you know, that's, I think, a, you know, a good a sort of digital fallback if there's not going to be an archive anywhere of it. But.
Well, but then also, I mean, what I was going to say is that the scattering of his books, the one way in which it sounds like that's a tragedy is that it sort of prevents him from being given a reputation after his death, from being sort of opened up and explained and understood in maybe a way that he wasn't when he was alive.
Right. Although it's hard to say if he would. I mean, there's been a little boomlet of press anyway, at least in the London Review books and Newsweek, and I think the LA Times the other day, like people covering this sort of odd human interest story. I mean, maybe it's even the case that, that by doing this, he's getting slightly more attention than he would have otherwise if it had just been sort of a you know, literary guy dies, obscure library in Central Texas, like, you know, boxes his books away, you know.
Yeah, but what it sounds like is happening is that people are both able to have the sort of joyful random experience of finding a book of his, mm-hmm. and the internet is making it possible to create that reputation.
Triumphalism, yay.
Well, I mean, we are doing an internet dialogue, so I feel like we have to endorse the forum. But I mean, I think that, you know, I think that kind of sort of serendipity and randomness is really, that's wonderful. It's not a story that I know that much about, mm-hmm. but it kind of makes me happy that both sides of that equation can be fulfilled. That, you know, he may get both his literary credit and give a lot of small joys and surprises.
Right.
You know, and it's much better than just, I mean, for preservationist reasons, it would be great if everyone who bought the books agreed to leave them to an appropriate library when they die or something.
Right.
But, you know, I like that people can get some fun, at least sort of intermittently.
Before. No, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love having, you know, Markson's copy of Sartre. Like, it's great. Here's, like, just a little bonus fact about Markson that maybe will tie this up mm-hmm. and shoot us into the next topic. But
yeah.
He actually started out as a genre novelist who wrote very pulpy crime stories and even this sort of satiric kind of post-Twainian Western yarn that was turned into a movie starring Frank Sinatra, which Markson apparently hated. But
that's really funny.
Yeah, and he turned into this kind of very, like, cloistered and, you know, gnomic kind of experimentalist later in life, but which is what he's best known for. But that early, it's like the Ballad of Dingus McGee, I think, is the title, and it's precisely as gonzo as it sounds. It's a fun read, and sort of it's fascinating to know that there's a guy out there who could sort of be a high priest of postmodernism in that way, who also had that kind of zany sense of fun. Also within the same brain, the same way that I think that today we want to be people who are capable of, you know, enjoying Lady Gaga and being able to go to the opera and not really feeling like there's, like, some great type of discordance there.
Yeah. Well, I write mostly about popular culture in the most popular sense. Partially because what I'm interested in is less, is this good? Because we live in a time when whether something is good doesn't really matter. We live in the era of the critic-proof movie,
right.
The critic-proof album. Well, this is why you reinvent yourself and say, good or bad doesn't matter. What does it mean that people like this or that this is critic-proof?
It's also a way to like enable a certain type of journalistic think piece, right? Which is, you know, a kind of second-degree question of like the way we blank now.
Yeah. Or also just to cheat and, you know, if you don't know very much about music, to say, I'm just going to write about the lyrics.
Right. Well, yeah.
that's my secret plan. I think it's interesting that, you know, if we are living in a postmodern age, whatever that means and whatever comes after, I love that we live in the age of genre fiction, whether it's on TV, whether it's books, and, you know, I think we were talking a little bit beforehand about Covert Affairs, this USA show.
Right.
And I think the USA Network has actually done a really amazing job of reinventing itself by doing sort of sly genre fiction.
Right.
You don't have, you know, you have a medical drama, but the doctor is sort of disgraced and bumming around and not helping poor indigent people. He's, you know, hanging out and curing the rich of their strange ailments.
Right.
you have a spy novel, you have not a spy novel, a spy show, right. Burn Notice, but the spy isn't fighting the Cold War. He's not even an official spy at all. He's hanging out in Miami and, like, threatening fashion designers and, you know, paying back old debts.
Though there's sort of a weird thing about these USA shows in particular, and both the shows you just mentioned are USA shows and, as covert affairs, but the doctor show Royal Pains and the spy show Burn Notice, there is an incredible amount of do-gooderism in both of those shows. There's always like some sort of long-term hide-the-ball kind of narrative that the showrunners use to keep the episodic thing pumping.
Yeah.
But I mean, then there's the procedural half of the show, which is like, oh, like I can't afford to get like an X-ray, or like I can't afford to get these guys who are, you know, these loan sharks off my back, and will you like beat them up for free, or will you like, you know, cut out my gizzard for free? And that's like, you know, the USA Network seems to have really done a lot of, like, they seem to have focus grouped this and become fairly confident on the point that that's really their model, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, one of the things that I like, I mean, I like their slightly deliberate offness. None of their characters are really,
sorry,
really weird.
The deliberate whatness?
Sort of, there's something off about all of the characters, right? Uh-huh. But they're not crazy. We don't have, you know, we don't have a charismatic serial killer in the network. We don't have,
right.
You know, it's not people who are truly deviant,
right.
But are sort of
gangster or whatever, right?
In some way.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think, I mean, I think USA does a very good job of giving us characters that indulge sort of our dual impulses to be cool and do good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, who doesn't like the idea of, like, doing good by beating up the bad guys? That's the whole, you know, I think that's the whole motivation behind Kick-Ass and the sort of teenage superhero fantasies at the moment that, like, we want to, you know, everyone wants to do something good for the world, but nobody wants to do it by, like, working in an African hospital.
Right, right.
Like,
you know, being a lame
doing
right.
Teach for America. Right. Like, you want to do it by being, like, a badass, sexy federal marshal in Arizona who, like, dates a washed-up minor league baseball player. Or
that's in plain sight, right? That's the...
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I mean, or... I mean, I think it's a very... It's a weird little network.
Totally.
And I think its weirdness works for it. I kind of admire it, actually.
Yeah, I think their batting average is sort of like, you know, 500. Like, I think that both In Plain Sight and Covert Affairs are really duds. I mean, there's only been like a couple of episodes of Covert Affairs, so maybe that's not fair to say. I think that Burn Notice and Royal Pains are like much funnier and even in some weird way slightly more believable, but I find like the bad guys that come chasing after the witnesses in Plain Sight to be like completely like,
hey, what if it's when like Richard Schiff is a badass rabbi? You can't get behind Richard Schiff as badass rabbi.
I can get behind Richard Schiff as like the weird guy in Burn Notice who is like one of the like myriad web of like 500 people who've apparently burned Michael Weston, but no, I mean
poor Michael Weston. I feel like he and Fiona need to go on vacation, and like he needs to see a therapist, and they need to get his mother a better house.
Right.
And he should just like go work for Lockheed Martin or like McKinsey. He should be a consultant. But yeah, he needs to be airlifted out of Miami and into a better life. I know you don't love Covert Affairs so far, and I think I actually really like it because in my former life,
right.
I was a bureaucracy reporter and a bureaucracy nerd, and it's one of the better shows about, like, how agencies work in Washington. They squabble over resources. They squabble over people. The people who are sent out to do work are really inexperienced. And, you know, this is sort of a light take on the fact that our intelligence community is growing and is increasingly screwed. Like,
but see, here's the thing. Like, how can it be one of these procedurals where, you know, Alias Junior, Piper Perabo, who it's so deaf to try to style it after Jennifer Garner and Alias, and they keep doing it, you know, with like the kind of like domestic home life drama that counterpoints the like crazy fight that she's just been in, you know. It's just like, I think I saw this on Alias, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, that may be true that it's reflective of the bureaucracy in some way that I'm unaware of.
Well, and I realize that nobody except me and people who work at Langley care about this.
This is
and
probably
I...
not a good business model for USA, though. But I mean, but I'm glad you dig it. Like,
there are, you know, the federal government is the largest employer in the United States. A great bureaucracy show has promise. I'm just saying.
Fair enough. Okay. I'll consider myself schooled on that one.
I don't mean to be delivering set downs, but, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think USA's sort of lack of seriousness is both a benefit from sort of a character perspective, mm-hmm. and also kind of a problem for long-term investment. Like, you know, cutie spies aren't people that it's easy to care a lot about. It's like, oh, she went to Sri Lanka and, like, had hot sex with this guy for 3 weeks, and he bought her a cowrie shell bracelet, and then he broke her heart, and it's very sad.
The bracelet in particular. I mean, really, come on.
It's kind of super tacky.
Yeah.
But
why don't you just go to sandals? I don't know, like turn it into The Office or something.
But yeah, I think USA is kind of our pop cultural future. It's smart. It's eclectic. It's weird. It's occasionally not very deep, but,
and also sort of, like, never really excellent. Like, never, like, oh my god, like, slap yourself, like, in the mirror excellent, which is, like, the back end of that deal, I think.
But do you think that, I mean, do you think what averages in television has the, you know, I'm trying to think of the best way to put this, has average in television gotten better? I actually feel like we're living in kind of a network TV resurgence. You know, we've got...
Is it a network TV resurgence, or is it like a cable TV? I mean, honestly, you're probably asking the wrong person at Newsweek. We have a great TV critic, Josh Alston, who will probably speak to this, like, a million times more eloquently than I would. But, I mean, I don't know. I don't have a television at home. I watch everything on iTunes or Hulu, and so, I don't know. I may not be the best person.
Well, that also makes you the future.
The future?
You know. We're getting away from our televisions. But yeah, I agree with you that we live in this sort of weird experimental age of pop culture, and what comes next, I'm not entirely sure. That might be a good place to end.
Yeah, for that, tune into our next dialogue, and we will absolutely have it all figured out.
Awesome.